This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors, carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Plato's Republic, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor David Ruchnik. Dr. Ruchnik is professor of philosophy at Boston University, where he teaches in both the Department of Philosophy and the Core Curriculum, an undergraduate program in the humanities. He completed his undergraduate work at Trinity College, where he majored in philosophy, and earned his Ph.D. at Pennsylvania State University. Prior to taking his position in Boston, Professor Ruchnik taught at Iowa State University. Dr. Ruchnik is the author of several books on Plato, including Of Art and Wisdom, Plato's Understanding of Techne, and Beautiful City, The Dialectical Character of Plato's Republic. He has published over 30 articles on a wide range of subjects in classical Greek philosophy and literature, and is the lecturer for the Teaching Company course Introduction to Greek Philosophy. Professor Ruchnik was awarded Boston University's Gittner Award in 1997 for excellence in teaching in the College of Arts and Sciences, and the 1999 Metcalf Prize for campus-wide teaching excellence. Professor Ruchnik prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. Plato's Life and Times.
Hello, my name is David Ruchnik, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this course on Plato's Republic. In this first lecture, I'd like to accomplish two things. First, I'd like to give you an overview of the entire course, and second, I'd like to give you a very brief look at Plato's life and times in order to give you some historical background that might enhance your appreciation of the Republic. Let me begin by first telling you a little bit about the book we're about to study together. Plato's Republic was written in approximately 380 BCE, before the Common Era. All the dates, by the way, that I cite from here on will be BCE, so I won't repeat that. Without a doubt, Plato's Republic was the first great work in the Western tradition that concerned itself with political philosophy. It's arguable that it was also the most influential in the whole subsequent history of Western political philosophy. Furthermore, it's even arguable that The Republic was the most influential book in the history of philosophy in general. As we'll see, the original and overriding concern in this book is political, but it will also move far beyond the political into questions that are of purely philosophical interest. Let me give you a little sense of why I made the claim that I did, that this is the first great work in the history of political philosophy, by simply listing for you a series of questions that Plato will address in the Republic. First and foremost, what is justice? What is the best life a human being can lead? What is education? What is the role education should play in a political system? Is censorship of music and literature ever justified? What sort of person should rule the state? Is it ever permissible for a ruler to lie to the citizens? Should citizens be allowed complete freedom when it comes to private property and sexual relationships? Are all citizens equal before the law? Should women have equal rights as men? Should all citizens have equal access to health care? This is nothing more than a small sample of the kinds of questions we're going to be discussing. I hope it gives you a little taste of what's in store. Let me turn next to the question of how we're actually going to proceed in this course. We'll operate with a very simple pedagogical strategy. We're going to read this book as carefully as we can. We're going to begin at the beginning. In fact, we will begin with the title of the dialogue, and we will work our way to the end. I consider it to be my job to try to bring this book to life. What I will suggest to you over and over again as we discuss various issues in the Republic is that these questions, even though they were initially formulated over 2,000 years ago, are alive and well today. Again and again, we'll see that Plato sounds like a contemporary. He doesn't seem, when you think about him, to be like a museum piece or a relic. He seems to be sitting next door to us and speaking directly to us and to our own concerns. Let me turn next to the structure of the dialogue. The Republic is very clearly structured. It has 10 books, we might call them chapters, and they can be organized into 4 separate parts. Book 1 is a prologue. It introduces the cast of characters. It suggests the most basic issue that we will pursue for the entire course, namely, what is justice? And the follow-up question to that is, why is a life of justice superior to a life of injustice? We then move to books 2, 3, and 4, the next stage of the Republic. And what we will find here is what I will call a construction project. The characters will construct a hypothetical or an ideal city, a city in speech, a city they will claim is, in fact, just. The next section is constituted by books 5, 6, and 7. And here we'll find a great digression. And we will find Plato telling us an enormous amount, not simply about politics and political philosophy, but philosophy in general. These central books of the Republic are sometimes referred to as just that, the philosophical books of the dialogue. And they are what justify the earlier claim I made that it is arguable that Plato's Republic is not only the most influential book in the history of political philosophy, but in philosophy in general. The last stage of the Republic is constituted by books 8, 9, and 10. And here we'll find the characters returning to the theme of real-world politics. Socrates, the hero of the dialogue, whom I'll discuss in just a few minutes, will discuss regimes that are unjust and very familiar to us today. To reiterate our pedagogical goal, we will work our way as carefully as time allows through each of these 4 sections of the dialogue. In the very last lecture of the course, I'll shift focus and I will concentrate on the amazing level of influence that the Republic has had in the subsequent history of political philosophy. let me say a few more words about the mechanics of this course. There are many good English translations of Plato's Republic. The one that I use and that I will occasionally cite from is by Alan Bloom. The book is listed in your bibliography. There's no need for you to use that translation only. I've listed several other translations in the bibliography as well. Even if you don't use the Bloom translation, which I'm using, you'll still be able to follow exactly where I am in the text. And this is because scholars have developed a standard paging system. The numbers of the text, which in most books will be in the margins and are called Stephanus page numbers, are the common page numbers that you'll find in any translation. So, for example, you will see the number 521A. That refers to page 521, that is Stephanus page. A refers to a paragraph or a series of lines. I will only refer to Stephanus page numbers in both my lectures and in the written material that accompanies this course. Let me turn next to a brief look at Plato's life and times. He was born in Athens in 429 to a very distinguished, powerful, and wealthy family. What this means, of course, is that he came of age in the 5th century in Athens. Now, I put some emphasis on that point because the 5th century in Athens is one of the most extraordinary centuries in the history of Western culture. It was an explosive century, and the events of that century, without a doubt, influenced Plato greatly. I'd like to give you a very brief chronological tour of the 5th century by listing a few dates and telling you some of the pivotal events that occurred at those times. Let's actually begin a bit earlier in the 6th century, 507. This is the date on which the Pisistratide tyranny that had ruled Athens was overthrown and a democracy replaced it. For the next 100 years, Athens was a democracy and was proud of being a democracy. Indeed, being a democracy went to the very heart and soul of Athenian self-identity. As you will see, as our course unfolds, the issue of democracy, a fundamental political issue, is never far from Plato's mind in writing the Republic. And we will discuss it from the beginning to the end. 480. This is the time when the Greeks defeated the Persians in the Persian War. Without going into any detail, the Persians had amassed an enormous empire to the east of Greece. They were an oppressive, tyrannical regime. They were expansionist, and they looked at Greece and wanted to conquer it. The odds of the Persians defeating the Greeks were huge because, again, the Persians had amassed an enormous army. Nonetheless, under Athenian leadership, the Greeks did defeat the Persians, particularly at the battles of Salamis and Plataea. Now notice, I've talked about the Greeks. Please realize that in antiquity, there was no country, Greece. That's a very, very late development. What there was a series of very small, independent city-states. Each of them was a self-sufficient political community on its own. Athens was one of those city-states. Sparta, Thebes, Corinth were others. It was under Athenian leadership that the Greeks pulled off this remarkable upset and defeated the Persians. I mention this because this is the beginning of Athenian greatness in the 5th century. Next date is 469. This is the time during which Pericles, the greatest of all Athenian political leaders, ascended to power. The subsequent decades have come to be known as the Periclean Age. And during this time, Athens became a great military, economic, political, and cultural power. We call it the Periclean Age, even though Athens, as I've suggested, was a democracy and proud of being a democracy still. There was no doubt that Pericles was first among equals. This was a time of explosion. Athens was expanding, again, not only in a military and political sense, but also, and perhaps more significantly, in a cultural sense. This is the time of the building of the Parthenon. It's the time of the great tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. It's the time of comic poetry. The great Aristophanes essentially invented the genre of comedy. Herodotus invented history. Thucydides, at the end of the century, some would say, perfected the genre of history. There were extraordinary developments in mathematics and in the natural sciences. It was, in short, a wonderful time. 431 is the beginning of the end, the beginning of the bad times in the 5th century. It was the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. Unlike the Persian War, when the Greek city-states were unified and were fighting against the Persians, during the Peloponnesian War, it was Greek against Greek. Most significantly, it was Athens against Sparta. 404, 27 years later, Athens lost. The length of time suggests how awful a war it was. It was a war that was prolonged at the cost of terrible bloodshed and destruction. And indeed, by 404, Athens, which had reached such levels of greatness only a few decades earlier, was brought to ruin. The worst aspect of this downfall for the Athenians was the destruction of their cherished system of democratic rule. Democracy itself was overthrown in Athens in the year 404. It was replaced by a group of tyrants who came to be known as the Tyranny of the 30. This was a traumatic event, to say the least. Fortunately, democracy was restored very quickly in the year 403. Nonetheless, the magnitude of this defeat of democracy was almost incalculable. And without a doubt, it made a gigantic impression on Plato. He was, in the year 404, 25 years old. He witnessed the destruction of his own city. As we read the Republic, I will refer over and over again to this fact, the Tyranny of the 30. It's not far from Plato's mind ever in the writing of the Republic. 399. Socrates was executed. I mentioned his name a few minutes ago. I don't yet want to tell you very much about Socrates because we're going to go into great detail about him throughout this course. Suffice it to say here that he was a philosopher and that he was Plato's philosophical inspiration. I'm tempted to say he was Plato's teacher, but in fact, I believe that would be inaccurate. I don't think Socrates actually taught anyone. He did, however, surely inspire Plato. The fact that he was executed in 399, and he was executed by the democracy, again, made a huge impression on Plato, certainly set his philosophical gears into motion, and led to the writing of the Republic. To sum up, Plato came of age in an extraordinary, tumultuous, heart-rending time. All of his subsequent philosophical work, I would argue, is informed by that period of time. What I have in mind in particular is that Plato is not simply an abstract thinker. He doesn't just cook up theories for their own sake, although he's awfully good at cooking up theories. Everything that Plato does philosophically is motivated by a concern for the real living of life in a city. He had witnessed things go bad in his own city of Athens. He had witnessed his philosophical inspiration, Socrates, be executed. When he writes Philosophy, when he composes The Republic, he's thinking about issues like that. At various junctures in this course, we are going to talk about very difficult, abstract, and conceptual issues. Try not to lose sight of this basic fact about Plato, that he was, from the beginning of his career to the end, concerned with the life of the city. Let me give you a couple of more dates which I think substantiate this point. 388. Plato took the first of his three trips to Sicily. Of course, Sicily is now part of Italy. In those days, it was actually Greek. Plato was visiting Sicily in order to work with a ruler who lived there whose name was Dionysus. What clearly Plato hoped for in interacting with Dionysus, in undertaking what was in fact a very difficult journey to go from Athens to Sicily, is very easy today. In ancient times, it required a great deal of effort. Plato made that effort because he had great hopes for Dionysus. What seems to be the case is that Plato hoped that in Sicily, with this ruler, he could put some of his ideas about politics into practice. Again, I mention this in order to suggest to you that Plato is not an otherworldly abstract philosopher interested only in beautiful concepts or beautiful theories. He's concerned with real human beings. His trip to Sicily, I believe, is evidence for that. He failed. He failed with Dionysus. He failed with Dionysus' son, Dionysus II. Perhaps as a result of this failure, Plato returned to Athens in 386, and he founded his own school. It was called the Academy, a word still used today. Our word academic derives from the name of Plato's school. It's very likely that Plato funded this school with his own money. He came from a very wealthy family. We don't know, unfortunately, much about what went on in the Academy, but we do know that it was devoted to the study of philosophy. And one thing that surely went on in the Academy was the study of political philosophy, the study of justice. Once again, I'm trying to make the point that while Plato removed himself somewhat in 386 from the rough and tumble world of politics, he nonetheless continued the effort, even when he was only working in the Academy, to make some connection, make some improvement to the real world of politics. I suggested that not only was Athens a great political and military power, it was also a great cultural power in the 5th century. I'd like to turn next to a brief look at some of the intellectual forces that no doubt helped to shape Plato's thought. I can begin very early and mention Homer and Hesiod, neither of whom was Athenian, both of whom, of course, were Greek. They lived and wrote somewhere between 750 and 700, and we will find a discussion of Homer and Hesiod in the Republic. So clearly, this is an influence on Plato's own thinking. In Athens itself, as I've mentioned, we find Aeschylus, who lived from 525 to 456, Sophocles, 496 to 406, and Euripides, 485 to 406. We find the great comic poet Aristophanes, from 450 to 385. Aristophanes even wrote a play that made fun of the philosopher Socrates. There were many philosophers in Athens. There were many philosophers in other Greek city-states before Plato. Sometimes these are called the pre-Socratic philosophers. Socrates lived from 469 to 399. The pre-Socratic philosophers are those philosophers who lived before or during the life of Socrates. Let me just give you some names and some dates. I would urge you to look up some of these figures. They're very interesting in their own right, and there's no doubt that they, once again, had a great influence on Plato's development. Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes were among the first philosophers. They lived in a town called Miletus, and they did their work in the 6th century. Heraclitus lived approximately 540 to 480. Parmenides lived from approximately 515 to 440. He, by the way, is particularly important. In fact, in one dialogue, a character written by Plato says, "Parmenides was my father," meaning my intellectual father. He had a great influence on Plato. Pythagoras, the great mathematical philosopher who, legend has it, discovered the Pythagorean theorem, lived from approximately 570 to 495. Anaxagoras, 500 to 428. Empedocles, 493 to 433. Democritus, 465 to 400, were among the most influential thinkers of the 5th century. Another tremendously influential group, a group with whom Plato was well acquainted, were known as the Sophists. These were itinerant teachers. They moved from city-state to city-state, and they mainly taught rhetoric. I won't go into any detail now about the Sophists, but we will talk about sophistry in some detail soon because, in fact, in Book One of the Republic, we will meet a sophist. His name is Thrasymachus, and we will talk about him at some length. For now, let me just give you some names and dates. Protagoras was often counted as the first great sophist, lived from approximately 485 to 400, Gorgias, 483 to 376, Isocrates, 436 to 338, lived during Plato's lifetime and was his great rival. That notion of a rivalry between the philosopher Plato and a sophist like Isocrates is pivotal. Once again, we'll take it up shortly when we turn to Book One of the Republic. Finally, there was Socrates, a name I've mentioned a couple of times. He lived 469 to 399, and he was far and away the greatest single influence on Plato. We don't know very much about this historical figure. He wrote nothing. We can make some guesses about who he was based on the writings of Plato, because Plato made Socrates the hero of many of his dialogues, including the Republic. There were other writers as well who discussed Socrates, but Plato, again, is our principal source. I want to make just a couple of points about Socrates because we will discuss him consistently throughout our discussion of the entire Republic. Unlike other pre-Socratic philosophers, Socrates concentrated on political and ethical questions. He was famous for asking a certain kind of question. It's known as the "what is it" question. He asked questions like, what is justice? What is courage? What is beauty? What is goodness? These are all humanly charged questions. After he would ask somebody a question and they would offer an answer, Socrates was very famous for then refuting their answer. This is known as the elenchus, the refutation. As a result of this, Socrates was a very annoying person. We'll see him at his annoyingly best throughout the Republic. He was described once as a gadfly, that fly that stings and irritates, but nonetheless wakes up an otherwise slumbering horse. We don't know exactly why Socrates was executed in 399. This is an issue we will talk about later, but we can guess. One reason, perhaps, is precisely the one I mentioned. He was so annoying. Let me close with a couple of important points, important warnings. It's impossible to tell whether the Socrates we will meet in the Republic bears any resemblance to the historical figure who lived between 469 and 399. After all, that person didn't write anything. So I want to be clear about one thing. Anytime I use the word Socrates, I am referring to the character who appears in Plato's dialogue. I am not making a claim about the historical figure about whom we really know next to nothing, except that he inspired Plato. A second point. The Republic, as you will see very shortly, is a complex and difficult work. As a result, it requires a commentator like myself to often engage in some interpretation. What I will try to be scrupulous about is telling you when I am offering you my own interpretation of a little bit of the text, and in the bibliography, I will offer you some alternative interpretations so that you can challenge my reading. I hope you enjoy your reading of the Republic, and I look forward to beginning.
Lecture 2, Book 1, The Title and the Setting.
We're ready to begin the actual dialogue, so let's begin right at the beginning. Let's think about the title. The title is The Republic, and that translates the Greek word politeia. The word politeia is derived from the Greek word polis, which itself is the root of our word political. Polis means city. And if you recall from the previous lecture, ancient Greece was not a country. It was a collection of small cities or city-states. We call them city-states because these were independent political entities. They were self-sufficient. The polis. The word politeia could also be translated as regime. A politeia is the organization of a city. It's how a city is structured. It's the kind of city, the form of the city that it is. We'll see that soon enough in what I described in Lecture 1 as the great construction project of the Republic, which takes place initially in Books 2, 3, and 4, Socrates himself will construct a city. He will construct a politeia, a regime. In his case, it will be an ideal regime, a regime that he will claim is perfectly just. Let's turn next to the setting of the Republic. I mentioned to you in Lecture 1 that Plato, whatever one thinks of his philosophical arguments, is undeniably a great writer. Very, very little is wasted in Plato. In other words, every small detail usually has significance. That's true of the setting of the dialogue. The first words of the dialogue are spoken by Socrates, and they are, "I went down to the Piraeus." The dialogue is set in the seaport of Athens. It's a few miles away from the city center. It's considered part of the general urban area that is Athens, but at the same time, it's removed. It's the Piraeus, the seaport. The dialogue is set, we believe, somewhere around the year 410. During the Peloponnesian War, has to be, obviously, before the execution of Socrates. Why is the setting significant? It's significant because during the tyranny of the 30, which I mentioned in the first lecture, took place in the year 404 when the Athenian democracy was overthrown, during the tyranny of the 30, the most concentrated opposition was located in the Piraeus. This was the stronghold of the democratic resistance to the tyranny. The setting of the dialogue, then, already suggests a major issue of the Republic, one which Socrates will take up explicitly, especially near the end of the Republic. And that is, what is the value of a democracy? Indeed, we might simply say that the issue of democracy, what is it? What is its value? Is it the best form of political organization, the best kind of politeia, is signaled at the outset of the dialogue simply by the setting. To put it, the point in slightly dramatic terms, the question raised by the setting of the Republic is a democracy worth dying for? Because that's what happened in the Piraeus. People died in order to overthrow the tyranny. Another question is signaled by the setting of the Republic. The Piraeus, like every major seaport in every country, is a place filled with foreigners, people who are not native to Athens, both Greek and non-Greek. A seaport, whether the seaport is New York City or London or any major city, is a place of great cultural diversity. Different kinds of people coming into the port in order to trade. I mention this because that word diversity is extraordinarily important in the Republic. And it's also extraordinarily important in political conversations today. Just think a little bit about how we use the word diversity today. It's widely taken to be an unambiguously good thing for a political community to embrace and affirm diversity. We think that being around different kinds of people with different kinds of ideas, being around different racial groups, different ethnic groups, is a good thing. The setting of the Republic should force us at the very beginning of our course to take a step back and ask ourselves, why do we think this? What is so good about diversity? This is an issue, once again, that will be taken up by Socrates and his companions explicitly later in the dialogue, and it's foreshadowed right here at the beginning. The opening scene takes place from lines 327a to 328d. You recall I mentioned these Stephanus page numbers. They should be available in any translation of the Republic that you're using. This opening scene, once again, foreshadows many of the issues that will later be taken up explicitly by the participants in the conversation. Socrates went down to the Piraeus. He went down in order to see a festival in honor of a new god. That's perhaps an odd phrase to use, a new god. But remember, the ancient Greeks were polytheists. The Greek gods were born. They didn't die, but they were born. So every once in a while, you could have a new god. And that's why Socrates is in the Piraeus. He's there to see a festival in honor of a new different, a foreign god. He's interested for reasons he doesn't explain. While he's down in the Piraeus, he is confronted by a man named Polymarchus. Polymarchus is the son of Cephalus. Cephalus is a very wealthy merchant who is not an Athenian. He is one of these foreigners that I've been mentioning. He is Greek, but he is not native to Athens. He lives in the Piraeus. Polymarchus, in a playful way, forces Socrates to stay. He pressures him. He doesn't literally force him. He doesn't threaten to break his leg if he tries to leave, but he urges him in the strongest possible terms to stay in the Piraeus for dinner. Now, I want to mention one thing about Polymarchus, which is, again, very dramatic and surely very intentional on Plato's part. Polymarchus was killed by the tyranny of the 30. So he was a casualty. He is someone who died fighting the tyrants. Socrates, for reasons he doesn't explain, doesn't seem terribly interested in this invitation. He seems to want to go home. Remember, the dialogue opens with him saying, "I went down to the Piraeus. Athens is located on a hill." He wants to go back up and return home. He is accompanied, however, by a young man named Glaucon. And it's Glaucon who insists that they stay in the Piraeus. Interestingly, Glaucon is, we know, Plato's brother. And we will soon encounter another brother of Plato. His name is Adeimantus. So we're going to have Socrates, Plato's philosophical inspiration, flanked by Glaucon, Plato's brother. Again, let me try to suggest the kinds of issues that are foreshadowed by this opening scene. I've already mentioned one, the idea of diversity or novelty. Socrates is interested in a new religious festival. He seems to be, as many of us would be, curious about new things. This raises the question, is cultural diversity a good thing? Is it good for a political community to allow different forms of cultural expression to flourish so that there can be many new things? This issue will be particularly sharp for us shortly, because when Socrates creates his own version of a politeia, of a city, he actually is going to be very critical of cultural diversity. So we'll come back to that issue when we get there. Another issue foreshadowed here at the very beginning of the Republic, in the opening scene, it's the question of force. It's playful. Polymarchus doesn't literally force Socrates to stay. He forces him in the way that we would playfully insist that somebody accept our invitation to a dinner. But the question of force is essentially a political question, and it will come back again and again in the Republic and, of course, in the entire history of political philosophy. Simply put, must the ruler exert force upon the citizens? Think, for example, of the question of law. Is law an imposition of force on the citizens? Why must citizens be threatened with punishment in order for the city to function well? To what level must a politeia, a republic, a regime, employ force? And at what point is there too much force? When is there enough force? When is there too much? When is there too little? These are questions that go to the very heart of the question, how does politics function? And they are elicited at the very outset in the opening scene. Another issue. Polymarchus is a young man, and like many young men, he is aggressive and full of energy. We see this expressed in his forceful demand that Socrates remain in the Piraeus. He's somebody who wants to get his way. He's very rich, so he's probably used to getting his way. Now, that may not seem like an overtly political issue, but in fact, as we'll see, especially when we turn to Book Two of The Republic, that is a political issue, in some ways, one of the most important political issues. It's the question of how does a city incorporate people like Paula Marcus? How can you have a well-functioning, orderly, just regime when you have individuals who want to get their own way, who might be willing, in fact, to trample on the desires of other people in order to get their own way? Needless to say, that's not an uncommon phenomenon. How does a city take care of such people? This will become a basic question in Book Two when we discuss the issue of education. I want to state it again because I think it's of such crucial importance. The presence of Paula Marcus, who appears only very briefly at the beginning of The Republic and has very little to say afterwards, is nonetheless important precisely because he died for his country, he died for his polis, he died for democracy. The Republic is one of the greatest reflections on the nature of democracy ever written. Many of the things that we will find Socrates saying about democracy will shock you. Socrates was a great critic of democracy. We live in a time where democracy is almost universally well thought of. As always, in reading Plato's Republic, I urge you to remain open to ideas that may strike you as foreign and even as uncomfortable. I can promise you, you will be repaid by good, hard thinking about issues like the nature of democracy. Let's turn next to the very first conversation, real conversation or first dialogue that Socrates has in the Republic. It's with the father of the household, Cephalus, and it runs from 328D to 331D. Cephalus is a very polite man, and he greets Socrates very warmly. He tells Socrates how much he's missed him, how he wishes Socrates would stay and come visit more often. And as you read this scene, note carefully Socrates' response, because Socrates responds by asking him a question. And it's a very strange question. It's a very rude question. And I'm going to paraphrase it. It's essentially the question, Cephalus, what's it like to be very old? In other words, he's asking Cephalus, what's it like to be close to death? I mean, to bring out the strangeness of this question, just imagine asking it yourself. Can you actually imagine going to a very old person and asking them that? We would tend, most people would tend, to shy away from that question. It's an uncomfortable question. It's an unbecoming question. It's an assertive question and perhaps even an aggressive question. It's rude, in short. Well, before examining Cephalus' response, I want to make a suggestion that yet again, Plato is giving us some clues to themes that will later be explored explicitly in the Republic. And the first clue is precisely the rudeness, the aggressiveness of this question. I suggest this is a clue about the character of Socrates, and indeed it's a clue about the nature of philosophy itself. Philosophy, as Plato conceives of it, and as Plato expresses it in his character of Socrates, is an enterprise which challenges convention, which challenges the notion of manners and of what people normally do, what people customarily do. Philosophy is, therefore, a potentially uncomfortable enterprise, and Socrates is a rather discomforting sort of man, as we will see very shortly. Let's go forward. Cephalus, interestingly, doesn't seem troubled by this question, what's it like to be so old? He says, He doesn't mind being very old. Why not? Socrates asks. Because, Cephalus says, I'm no longer troubled by my sexual desires. Might be a surprising answer. I'm no longer driven crazy by sex. He says this as explicitly as can be. Some of your translations, especially if you use older translations, may try to sugarcoat the language a little bit to make it sound a bit more becoming. But in fact, this is exactly what he means. He means, when I was a young man, a man like Polemarchus, his son, or a man like Glaucon, Socrates' companion, I was driven crazy by my desires. Not a surprising description. He was driven crazy by eros. Eros in Greek means, first and foremost, sexual desire. It means, more broadly, love. And we are very familiar with the phrase, I'm madly in love. And that's precisely the word Cephalus uses to describe the passions of his youth. They were maddening. And now, very old, very calm, very peaceful, not so bad. He kind of likes it. He also says, I'm not really afraid of dying. And that's because I'm very rich. He doesn't say that, but we know that. And as a result, I can always pay back my debts. I can always perform sacrifices to the gods. I've always been able to tell the truth to other people, keep my promises. And as a result, I'm not afraid of what will happen to me in the next world. So, two reasons then. He's very calm, he's very peaceful, and he doesn't find growing old to be quite so burdensome as some people might. What happens next is very dramatic. It's not dramatic in terms of action. It's very dramatic philosophically and very revealing of an important feature of Socrates, a feature I mentioned in the first lecture when I was talking about the historical Socrates. From these rather casual remarks that Cephalus makes about being old, Socrates extracts a definition of justice. He turns to Cephalus and he says, and this is line 331c, aha, this is what you mean by justice. This is your definition of justice. It is, I quote, the truth and giving back what a man has taken from another. Cephalus had said, I always tell the truth. I don't have to lie. I keep my promises. I can pay my debts. Now, at this point, I've always imagined Cephalus looking rather surprised. From his rather casual remarks about growing old, Socrates has forced him into giving a definition of justice. Justice itself, Socrates says, is telling the truth and giving back what a man has taken from another. Isn't it? That's the question he asks Cephalus. Now, before Cephalus has a chance to recover from what I imagine to be his shock at having all of a sudden discovered that he had been giving a definition of justice, Socrates refutes it. Remember, I said in the first lecture that Socrates was famous for two things, the historical Socrates. He was famous for asking the question, what is it? The what is it question is the question that asks for a definition. And he was famous for refuting people who attempted to answer the question. And that's exactly what's going on in the early scene in Book One of the Republic. So Socrates refutes the definition with what's called a counterexample. Imagine that a friend of yours lends you a knife, a very long and sharp knife. And then your friend goes insane. And he comes to your door and he says, give me back my knife. I lent it to you. You promised you would return it to me. Give me back my knife. You take a look at this man. His eyes are red. He has violence written all over him. Should you give him back the knife? Would it be just to give him back the knife? Would it be just to tell him the truth? Should you look at this guy and say, no, I'm sorry, you look insane, and therefore I'm not giving you back your knife, even though I promised I would? Socrates states, no, this would be the wrong thing to do. It would not be just to tell the truth. It would not be just to give back what you borrowed. Remember, those are the critical features of Kephalus's first definition of justice, the definition that he did not intentionally give. This is, in an important sense, the real beginning of the Republic, because now we are faced with the question, the famous Socratic question, what is justice? We're faced with the task of giving a definition. Now, before going further, I'd like to just reflect a little bit on this task of giving definitions, this task that's engendered by the what is it question. Like so many things in Plato, this apparently very simple question is actually deceptively complicated and very controversial. Every question that you ask always presupposes some sort of answer. I'll give you an example to illustrate what I mean. If I asked you who won the baseball game last night, I don't know the answer to the question. But I'm presupposing a lot simply by asking the question. I'm presupposing that there was a baseball game. I'm presupposing that there was a winner of the baseball game. I'm presupposing that you might know the answer to the question, which is why I asked you. The what is it question, just like the question who won the baseball game, also has many presuppositions based into it. First and foremost, it has the presupposition built into it that there is a possible answer to it. I think this is what questions seem to presuppose, rather obviously, the possibility of answers. Now, it's not so obvious, however, that a question like what is justice actually has an answer. Because if it does have an answer, that answer, the definition, would then become what philosophers call a universal. This is the requirement of a definition. If I give a definition of something, then it becomes universal in the sense that every single example of that something must be covered by the definition. So, for example, I'll give you a definition of a hat. A hat is a covering for the head. Every single particular hat must be embraced by that definition. The definition is universal, and the particulars are instances of that universal. Now, two more points. The first is there really an answer to the question, what is it? What is justice? Is there a universal sense of justice? This is going to become, as usual, an explicit issue shortly. It's an issue that, again, as usual, is foreshadowed by the question that Socrates is asking Kephalus. It's built into the question. Socrates believes there is an answer to the question, what is justice? Therefore, Socrates believes that there must be some universal justice. The second point I want to make about this question, just to dramatize it, is let's think of this example I just used, a hat. If I were to ask you, what is a hat? If I were to ask you, in other words, give me a definition of a hat, it's actually not so easy. The working definition I offered you was a covering for the head. Well, what about a helmet? A helmet covers the head. Is a helmet a hat? What about a visor? That sort of covers the head. Is a visor a hat? Now, a hat is a rather innocuous little thing that we wear. The point I'm trying to make is that it's rather hard to give definitions. It's hard to give a definition of an object as simple as a hat. What would you imagine is the difficulty of giving a definition of justice? Socrates asked this question as if the question can be answered. The point I'm trying to make is he seems to be presupposing a lot. He's presupposing that it can be answered,